Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's irate debate and calamitous commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today's episode, Misinformation in the Information Age. Are you caught in a worldwide web of lies? I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Bruce.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
I found this really cool thing online. Did you guys know that Mr. Ed was actually a zebra they painted for the show?
Really? That seems odd. Did you check Snopes on that?
I did. It's right here.
Well, actually, I checked SnopesWatch.org, and they say Snopes is lying again.
So, yeah, how do you decide who to believe in a case where you're given some strange piece of information?
That's always a perpetual problem, especially on the internet these days, although, I mean, it happens certainly in real life too, but with the spread of information, the democratization of information and things like journalism on the internet, that seems to be becoming a persistent problem.
Well, first of all, I think we should throw out the fairly commonly noted observation. I'm not sure how true it is. People are more likely to find something sufficiently plausible to pass it on upon hearing it if it agrees with their worldview.
That seems fair. I mean, if you're already of the mindset that some feature or function in the world is a thing to be concerned about, you are more likely to believe a story that dovetails well with that concern. If I think that the government is probably conspiring and keeping secrets, then I'm more likely to take that as a baseline from which to evaluate other evidence.
I've seen plenty of people on Facebook or Twitter that have definitely posted things that were a little questionable because they agree with something about it. Like, I've seen people on Twitter who post something about how meat is literally worse for you than smoking cigarettes because it agrees with their vegan point of view, or that vaccinations secretly give everyone cancer or something of that ilk.
Let's start with some discussion about the notion of critical thinking. We've talked a lot in the show's history about critical thinking as a concept, but we don't really talk a lot about what it means to think critically. We talk about the importance of it, but less about what the specifics are of thinking critically. So let's start there and try and weed out what would be a good or a bad source.
Critical thinking, at least for me, is looking at something, piece of information, a news article, something like that, and kind of breaking it down, pulling it apart and making sure everything that they posit in the article or in the fact is actually in some way actually founded in reality, or that it's on the level, that it's not shaded by some form of bias or another. And if it is, kind of trying to pick out what's actually happening sans bias.
I think one of the important things with making sure you're thinking critically when dealing with this kind of information is to make sure that your goalpost is set and doesn't move. I've set my level of skepticism here. This is the level at which beyond I'm willing to nominally believe this thing. And I'm going to break down the elements of why I would think this is true, add them up, and I'm not going to move my goalpost based on whether I would like it to be true, whether it fits things that I like to be true, but do it sort of very, very quantitatively, almost scientifically, although this kind of information isn't quite as quantitative. I just want to make sure that I'm not going to shift my goalposts.
Right. I think that something that dovetails well with that is the idea that critical thinking entails a willingness to be wrong. You have to be prepared to say, the thing that I believed yesterday has been shown to be incorrect by whatever goalpost was set, and I am now willing to, and hopefully are glad to, give up that belief in favor of one that is more supported by the evidence at hand. And I think that that's a trap that we get caught in a lot, where we would like one thing to be true, in part because it means we're not wrong about the world.
This is particularly an issue when the kind of thing under discussion is something that we identify with, that we may perhaps we're raising a flag or banner on the side of a particular controversy or a political side. So our identity becomes wrapped up in with the world being this way, and therefore if it turns out that this thing is false, that actually emotionally hurts us, and we react angrily with it by arguing against it.
I think that something important when talking about critical thinking as it pertains to things that we read, articles, news, stuff like that, we need to be careful to watch out for confirmation bias, which is a form of kind of positive reinforcement by reinforcing the one's already held beliefs or worldviews.
You know, River, you raise a particularly valid point. I've found lately that I seem to see confirmation bias everywhere I look.
And that's the basis of confirmation bias. If you're looking for something, if it's aware on the top of your mind, you'll find it. Because it's on the top of your mind, and therefore you're filtering out of the background noise of the huge amount of information that we're inundated with nowadays.
To a large extent, critical thinking is a process of active attention paying to the sources and concepts that we're dealing with. It is, rather than passively hearing and accepting or attaching value based on the source that we believe to be good, it's an active involvement with the ideas that we are accepting and trying to discover, understand, parse, I guess is the term I'm looking for. Critical thinking is about actively being a participant in the things you know, as opposed to simply being a passive receptacle for information to fall into. So how do we take that concept and look at the sources of information that we have in the modern world? Because we have a lot of sources of information, more than at any other time in human history. We have easy access to a vast array of sources, both good and bad. We have access to more media, more TV, more radio, more voices. We have podcasts, which obviously are never wrong. We have Wikipedia, we have other online sources, BuzzFeeds, and other new media journalism style sites. We've talked a little bit about journalism and sources and the ethics of that in the past, but there are so many available sources. How do we parse those?
One common tactic I've found that's useful when being on the internet and seeing something that might be an outrageous claim is to figure out where that source got its source from. Where this information's coming from. Is it coming from a relatively reputable source like Reuters or the Associated Press, which occasionally does get stuff wrong, don't let me be mistaken, but often tries to be very on the level and very factual with the news it reports, reporting what has happened less than what the Associated Press reporter feels from that happening. But if the article's source is a blog or a website that's been set up to push these very out there ideas or very seemingly nonsensical or non-ideal ideas, you might take that with a little more skepticism than a more confirmed source.
So two techniques you raised there. One of those is link tracing, which is really important. Obviously, very oftentimes, first of all, you got to get people to cite sources. Follow the source. Very often, that's an article that's got a certain spin on it, but they will have link where they got it from. You follow that, and you can trace them back. Even people's claim about, oh, Wikipedia can be edited by anyone, it's fine. Wikipedia cites its sources. You can find out where that piece of information is, go to the bottom, follow the link, find out where it came from, get all the way to the source. Second thing is, yeah, reputability, professionalism. People can argue about, you know, what's the media bias of that professional news organization, but journalism does have objective techniques for reducing bias and for double-checking and verifying information, and reputable journalist agencies pay people who do the work to do that. So there's a quantifiable and objective basis by which you could say, okay, the things that they print are more likely to be true.
I think that's fair, and there is also an interesting question that gets brought up in there, and that is, why skepticism? Why should we be skeptical of these things? The philosophical position of skepticism, taken to its logical extreme, excludes all information, does not believe anything. Obviously, that's usually not the position most people are arguing for when they argue for a skeptical mindset of some sort. But in essence, what skepticism is an attempt to know as few untrue things about the world as possible. It is not an attempt to know the most true things about the world. An attempt to know the most true things about the world would inherently believe all of the things all of the time, because then you would know 100% of the true things about the universe. You would just also know 100% of the false things. So the question is, what we're trying to get out of this process. And I think for most people, the answer is we want the best mix we can have. We want the highest ratio of true to untrue things known about the world around us. If that's the goal, neither complete skepticism nor complete acceptance will get you there. And so it's very important to modulate and decide about what things to be skeptical, because skepticism can certainly lead us down the wrong trails. When we talk about conspiracy theories in particular, we get into people who are very skeptical of a lot of sources, and in a lot of ways, their skepticism leads them to untrue things.
If you set your bar incredibly high for skepticism, if you're being skeptical over official reports, for example, such as for any official tragedy like JFK assassination or September 11th, the problem is you're not just saying, I either believe this or nothing. We all do have to believe something in order to function in the world. And I think we're making a categorical error of saying, I can either believe this or not, because actually, you either believe it or you believe some form of alternative, some alternative narrative that seems plausible to you. So if I disbelieve the official report, I must believe something else. And that something else might be more implausible than however I've deemed the official implausible report to me. If I don't believe that crashing airplanes into the Twin Towers is sufficient to knock them down, then what I actually do believe must be something along the lines of the government used hundreds of people to lace both buildings with bombs all the way up, then used planes to crash into them unnecessarily because they could have just blown up the bombs they put in the building and blamed the terrorists instead of also using the planes and pulled off the whole thing perfectly without a hitch, with none of the people involved ever speaking out about it. And that the government is the government doing the secrets conspiracy thing is competent in a way that government has never been shown to be, either in its public or in actual conspiracies it's done that have been exposed. So it's not that I don't believe the official report because I think it's too implausible. I actually believe something that's far more implausible when you put it all together.
This is basically the Sherlock Holmes problem. Sherlock Holmes has this great quote that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote for him. When all probable solutions have been eliminated, the improbable that remains, no matter how unlikely, must be true. If I eliminate all of the sources of probabilistic information, whatever's left, the thing that I have deduced by removing these other sources, is the thing that I will believe in, no matter how little likelihood it seems to hold with the rest of the system.
But I may have eliminated things because they seem to have a probability threshold below, say, 7%, and what I've come up with after having eliminated them is something which has a probability threshold of 3%. I'm going to say this is something people get wrong about Sherlock Holmes. I think Conan Doyle might have gotten wrong about him, because he often says he's doing deductive reasoning. What Holmes actually does is abductive reasoning, which is comparing probabilities of different possible schemes. You never just believe something or not. You either believe something or you believe an alternative.
I don't necessarily think that's true, because there is uncertainty. You can be uncertain about something. You don't necessarily have to believe that that is one thing or another thing is 100% the case. Like with JFK, do I think he was killed by a pissed off communist sympathizer? Probably. Do I think there's more that could have been done by the Secret Service? Also probably. Do I think there was a guy at the Grassy Knoll with another gun that got in another shot? Probably not. There's always mystery surrounding things, especially national tragedies or large tragedies that might go unanswered, that we might not know. One really big point that the conspiracy theorists use to try and frame the JFK assassination as government cover-up is the fact that Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald before they got an opportunity to interrogate him. So a lot of people posit that Oswald was working for the government at the time, or that there was a government cover-up because Jack Ruby was having some financial debt at the time. There might have been a government organization that used that as leverage to get him to kill Oswald. Whenever there's mystery or strangeness surrounding something, which often happens because sometimes there's information that the government feels the public shouldn't know for whatever reason, either national security or something else, usually they claim national security, it's, you know, people will start filling in the gaps, and sometimes they do that in the weirdest ways.
I think you're actually bringing up another interesting tool that people should be mindful of when doing this sort of thing, when being skeptical of something, is to just be honestly willing to say, I don't know. I don't think it's that, but I don't have a better solution for it, because many of the conspiracy theorists often do jump from, well, I don't believe the official story, so I've got this whole conspiracy story that I do believe in, to just say, I don't think it's that, but I don't really know. It's okay to not be more certain of something else than we are of this in order to doubt this. We can just doubt it and shrug our shoulders.
I think the JFK and the assassination conspiracy theories around it actually brings up a really good example of what we were talking about a minute ago with regard to one idea being less probable and still more prevalent than another. And this is the way that the conspiracy theorists around the JFK assassination have used what they call the magic bullet argument. So according to many of the conspiracy theorists, basically, in order for this to not have had a second shooter, the bullet would have had to have magically passed through, turned around, and come back to approximate the angles and trajectories involved in the shooting. This is used to present the other side as less probable than the conspiracy angle is. Now, whether you believe that or not, it's interesting to note that the same analysis process, the same questioning of the probabilistic truth of one thing over another, can be used in both ways.
So interestingly, the sort of narrative method, if it were true, in comparing that to the official story that I used to critique September 11th earlier, is kind of reversed with the JFK thing, because as I was saying, that if it were true, it would be even more implausible and difficult. But if you think about JFK, if I were the controller of a shadow government and wanted to assassinate the President of the United States, using one patsy to do it, a second patsy to kill the first one, and then having that one hang himself in his cell would be a good way to remove myself from and cut out from it. But the entire notion that we do things, that these things have been done very efficiently and effectively and cleverly, the way we would think about doing them, is belied by things like the Watergate burglary, which was a complete bumbling mess. MK Ultra, which is, you know, as soon as it was found out, it was completely fell apart. When it turns out the government agencies are doing things they oughtn't and they get caught for it, they get caught for it, and they do a terrible job of separating the powerful people from the people who did it. The method by which we've actually changed the conspiracy theory game in the modern age is actually was invented with Iran-Contra with Oliver North. Which is to say, I did the things you accused me of, and I did it because I'm a patriot. Now everybody knows about it, and I shouldn't get in trouble for it because nobody cares. Various members of the Bush administration became very good about this. Hey, we caught you doing this thing you're not supposed to do. Yeah, well, I did it because I believe in freedom. And they don't get in trouble for it. So the conspiracies are all out in the open now.
So let's talk a little bit about conspiracy theories, not in terms of the actual conspiracies themselves, but why we are so eager, it seems, to believe in them in the first place. We've cited that there's some very good reasons to not buy a lot of the conspiracy theories that are out there, but they persist. People continue to think that they are true and to believe in them, and if that's the case, there seems to be some kind of draw there. It seems to me that it's using a form of memetics. That this is a kind of mind virus that is very good at propagating because it leaves us with a lot of unanswered questions that we as humans are not good at leaving blank spaces in the system.
I think also part of it is the sort of cold comfort that a person can get from having someone to blame back in the olden days, if something went bad, the devil was blamed, or some malicious force, a witch. I think this kind of ties into that. This is, something bad is happening right now, and this is a very clear target to blame, the government being a very clear, well, they must be behind it because bad thing happened, as opposed to just kind of accepting that sometimes shit just happens. And so I think that there's an amount of comfort that you can get from blaming the sort of faceless, big, bad, shadowy organization that is the government.
I think that comfort is right on point. I was going to say something about that, because it would be comforting to think that we live in a universe where the bad things that happen at least happen on purpose. The idea that the bad things happen because the powers that be are at least partially inept, and so bad things happen by accident. It's almost better to think that the bad thing happens because the people who really run things, those bastards, wanted it to happen. But they are, at least they're incredibly efficient and organized. At least we're in competent hands, however evil they may be. I think there's a certain comfort to that. Plus, it's a more exciting world to live in.
Yes. You can take comfort in the fact that no matter how evil they may be, everything is under control.
Well, and obviously, for those of us living under the boot of Professor Metal, we all know that competent hands are handling our affairs. But for the rest of the world, there's got to be a certain kind of existential dread at the notion that huge and terrible things can just come out of nowhere, that no one can foresee or control the circumstances that would permit these things to happen. Because then how do you go about your daily life? How do you feel comfortable going out, say, to a large public place, knowing that at any time somebody could suddenly decide to detonate a bomb? That somebody who just has an extreme point of view on the world may have snuck in a pressure cooker full of nails and some explosives.
So on the one hand, it's completely uncontrollable. We can't predict or do anything about it. On the other hand, is part of some grand and complicated plan by some incredibly efficient people who secretly run everything. I think it's a similar comfort to people maintaining faith in God's mysterious ways in the face of evil in the world. There seems to be a parallel there between a political version of God and his plan. Psychologically, it serves a similar respect. There is someone out there who wanted or let this happen. They've got some complicated plan for the world. I may or may not agree with it, or perhaps it's beyond my understanding, but that's why it happened, as opposed to shit just happens.
I think you have a point in that there is a certain comfort in believing that there is a reason for a terrible tragedy to occur. That we, as humans, reach out for something to make sense of a cruel and seemingly hostile world around us. What you find at the other end of that is sort of up to the kind of life that you live and the place that you are and the people around you. But I think there's a basic human desire to reach out for meaning in those circumstances, to give some sort of understanding to a circumstance that otherwise reminds us how small and frail we are.
I definitely agree. And I think also part of it is, especially in regards to conspiracy theories, is there are plenty of people, I'm certain, that don't want to accept what the official answer is. They don't want to accept that one pissed off communist forever changed the face of American history, or that a few very pissed off radical Muslims completely wiped a couple of buildings and several thousand lives off the map. It seems too simple, too clear-cut, in a way, for some folks to kind of deal with. They feel that there has to be something more to it, not just that there might be, but there has to be. There has to be some bigger, more sinister plot going on to try and take control of this, that, or the other thing. And that's where it comes from. That's why you get things like the Illuminati theories or the government plan 9/11 is because that way it makes more sense that some giant unknowable organization has done this for secret gains as opposed to some pissed off people just wanting to do damage.
And I think that there's another element that goes on in this, and that's that if you are one of the people who believes in these sort of vast conspiracies and highly orchestrated plots going on in the world, there is a sense that you are one of the special people, that you know about it. You are one of the people who sees the truth behind the lies.
Wake up, sheeple.
Robert Anton Wilson referred to folks like that as the illuminated, the ones who saw the fenords, the things that nobody else had the ability to see because of public programming in his Illuminatus trilogy. He was a cataloger of sorts of conspiracy theories and also used them heavily in his writings, something that would go on to be done by Dan Brown and a number of other famous authors, but he kind of was one of the first well-known authors to go, well, what if these are all true? What would a world like that look like?
I think that there's a part of human psychology that just makes us want to be the special people, to want to be in the club, to be in the know, to be one of the people who knows what's going on while all the rest of the people don't. And you may be trying to tell them, but they just won't listen to your secret wisdom of some sort. I think that this is a deep psychological need that we all have in some way to be unique and special, and that this fulfills that for some people. That for at least people who are highly prone to these kinds of theories, this serves as a way to be apart from the crowd.
Not only that, not only are you the hero of the story, you live in a far more interesting world than the other people. They live in a world where things go wrong, people make mistakes, disasters happen. You live in a world where everything is an exciting adventure.
So, we've talked about some of the more famous conspiracies, but let's shift a little bit from conspiracies and talk a little bit about perhaps one of the most pervasive ways in which manipulating the sources of information is used. And that's a favorite topic here, advertising. We manipulate one another as part of our basic social structure through the process of advertising and marketing.
You always hear about the new sneakers that are out that will make you run faster or jump higher, make you a better athlete, just better at your everyday life. There's definitely a air of misinformation around some of the things, especially things like the As Seen on TV products is a huge example of this, because they're products that are at least advertised to make your life so much easier that you won't understand how you could have lived without them before, even though they tend to be things like little bits of plastic and just a new spin on an old concept or something of that ilk.
Well, implications are one thing, but I think when we're within the context of separating truth from flat-out falsehood, but I think that, you know, herbal supplement industry has been guaranteed a huge loophole to commit massive fraud that no other industry is allowed to get away with. And they will flat out make claims that are false. Get away with it for a number of years, maybe get slapped with a little bit of lawsuit, start up with something else.
Homeopathic treatments is also another great example of something where we just allow outright falsehoods to be proclaimed. The belief that somehow a diluted version of a poison is the cure for that poison makes no sense scientifically, has no backing in studies that have ever been done, and yet we continue to see the claims over and over again, you know, cures this or that, prevents yeast infections, may clear up mucus from water.
I could understand if it made sense intuitively, but you know, there was no scientific study to it. But for some reason, it's like less of something is the opposite of more of it.
Actually, something kind of interesting that I saw recently while I was at Fry's, which is a chain of electronics retailers that's active at least in the Northwest, I believe elsewhere because they're owned by Kruger's. has a section of as seen on TV products, and it actually had one of these homeopathic remedies as one of the as seen on TV products. That's a skin tag remover, which is just a little bit of skin that kind of hangs off you, hence the name. And the active ingredients were said to be homeopathic. But what was interesting that I noticed was that the inactive ingredients, the filler ingredients, were things like cedar oil and certain other essential oils that might actually do it. But because homeopathic treatments, along with many other herbal supplements and things of that ilk, are not regulated by the FDA, they didn't have to declare that as part of it. Otherwise, they might have to submit it to the FDA. So there might actually be a weird bait and switch where they're claiming with some of these products, I can't say for certain, I'm not a medical professional, if it ends up working, it's probably those quote-unquote inactive ingredients actually doing the job as opposed to the homeopathic treatment, but they will claim that it's the homeopathic treatment that's actually doing the job.
Well, it's nice of them to throw in something that might work along with their bullshit. But it being an as seen on TV thing is an interesting thing because it is a way of saying to people, hey, you may not believe this if I sold it to you, but if I tell you that this is being advertised on television, then, well, you might think that's more plausible and more appropriate. FCC must check the things that are advertised on television.
Sure, and this is basically an appeal to the wisdom of crowds. It says, if this is something that's being advertised on television, then it is something that lots of people are seeing and buying, and if it wasn't any good, I'd have heard by now that that thing wasn't any good or that this was a scam. Thus, by it being a widely available product, I can believe some level of credibility for its value.
And this is kind of where we get back into confirmation bias and the internet for providing that confirmation bias, because there's a chance, and probably a very high one, that that product may have been disproven or might have been spoken out against. But if you're not searching for that, if you're searching, does this actually work, this thing actually work, you're going to find sites that may erroneously say that it does and not see any of the sites that says it doesn't, that may actually have some backing to it. And vice versa, if you see something and you're skeptical about it, you might go online and see, does this not work? And you might find some people who say, well, this didn't work for me, and use anecdotal evidence, especially for things like I've seen that happen for medicines. This didn't actually work for me, therefore it doesn't work at all. Whereas for some people it might, and some people it might not.
This actually raises an interesting point regarding having discussions on the internet, trying to separate the signal of truth from the noise of falsehood, is that there are plenty of websites, whether they're blogs or whatnot, that contain every possible opinion. And very often, and when you get in a heated debate with someone, they'll give a very strange opinion, and then they'll say, look on the internet, do your research, study it. And they're basically telling you to cite their sources. And if I go and look for their opinion on the internet, sure enough, I'll find thousands of hits of websites that say the thing that they believe. And they submit this, and this is a wisdom of crowds thing, they submit this as evidence. There are lots of web pages that agree with me, and reading those would constitute researching to whatever evidentiary standard is contained on those web pages. But the thing is, every possible opinion that anyone could come up with, the same is true. I have exactly as much evidence and in exactly the same form to say Queen Elizabeth is a lizard alien. Go look at it and do your research. You'll find thousands of web pages with lots of claims and information and citations there. Every possible opinion is subject to this method equally.
I'm glad you brought up the notion of the signal-to-noise ratio problem, right? Because I think that to a large extent that is the best model for understanding what the vast democratization of information has done for us in the modern age. Having more access to information seems on its face like a good thing. Inherently, having more information seems like a good thing. But it is only as good as the value of the information that you have. Having more bad information does not help your situation. And we have unfortunately found ourselves in a position of not culturally coming to the point of understanding how to parse that information while at the same time being given access to it. the internet has been a revolutionary force, and I think largely for good. However, one of the pitfalls, one of the more problematic elements of it is that we got there so fast. We went from 0 to 60 in very little time, and culturally we did not adapt to have the kind of critical reasoning and skeptical mindset that's required to parse the amount of information that we now have access to.
So much less of the information we get comes through gatekeepers. There's no Walter Cronkite anymore, who everyone listens to, and even those we've spoken of, more reputable journalistic news outlets, there are far fewer of them, and certainly far fewer as a percentage of the media that we get. Most of the opinions and factoids and news items and things that I get passed to me are passed by my Facebook friends to me. People who think like me, who are just as likely to think that this is plausible, and that's how the information filters to me, sort of not top down, but parallel.
And the dangers of information homogeny, of living in a bubble where it only echo chambers the ideas you already have, is certainly one of the many pitfalls that we face in dealing with information in the digital era. That said, though, is it any better than the options that we had before? Like, in what ways were the more controlled gatekeeper styles of media more valuable than, say, the grassroots passing of information?
Well, I don't know that I'd necessarily say that it was better, although the signal-to-noise ratio definitely was less of a thing, quote-unquote, back in the day. But at the same time, you had people like Walter Cronkite and Ed Murrow actively challenging a lot of things. Like, Murrow, during the McCarthy era, was one of the few reporters actively challenging the reports coming out from the House Select Committee on American Activities at the time, which was not a popular thing necessarily because we were in the middle of the second Red Scare. But he helped expose a lot of the corruption and the problems that was going on with it. And because of him and Walter Cronkite and Woodward and Bernstein, who blew open Watergate, journalism was for a while considered a somewhat noble profession because they were constantly challenging the status quo and the problems in society, both with our government and with our society as a whole. And because of things like cable news and the 24-hour news cycle coming about, that's kind of become watered down. And I think there are a lot of people who've become disillusioned with that since then. And there are also a lot of people who still hold on to that notion, and why certain news organizations that shall not be named here get away with claiming outrageous things or flat-out false things, and people actually believe them because they still believe they're completely on the level because of these old journalists that really took their job seriously and asked hard-hitting questions.
I think the difference in this new method of us getting all of our information from each other instead of getting it from a select group of professionals goes to do with this with these different epistemic goals that you mentioned earlier, Sean. Do we want to know as few false things as possible? Do we want to know as many true things as possible? Or do we want to have the highest ratio to true to falsehood? Under that old method of these professional journalists who were studied and who were driven, we were knowing as few false things as possible, although we not necessarily get to know very many true things for them. There was less information, but there was very little noise. Now we know a lot of false things. And we know a lot of true things, and we know a lot of bold things. And I think it comes up to, this is a recurring theme with us as well, it comes up to each media consumer to use effective techniques to try to navigate through this and to do the best job of sifting as they can.
So I think that to a large extent, the value of grassroots, as it is popularly called, or what might be more accurately called, lateral information distributions, is that we have access to more sources. Having access to more sources means access to information that we might not otherwise have. But it does mean that by having that additional information, each of us has a greater responsibility for the information that we take in. when we are talking about a Murrow or a Walter Cronkite or some other trusted name, someone who we put, in some sense, our faith in, that person's integrity, to be the person who keeps the wrong information out, the person who decides for us in some ways which things we should hear about and which things are garbage news. When we do that, we don't have to take a lot of personal responsibility. We give it to that person. But when we encounter a world of lateral information gathering where I receive information from all the people around me, it is now my job to parse that for what is valuable and what is not. And it becomes incredibly important for me to understand not only the sources and the types of information that I'm getting, but my own motivations in accepting or rejecting pieces of information. And I think that that's possibly the most important lesson we can take back to the advertising conversation, which is that if I am in an environment that provides me lots of sources of information, like whether or I should take Advil, Tylenol, or Naproxen for my headache, it is the job of the consumer in an environment where I have lots of information and option to be able to parse that. Whereas if I just trust my doctor to tell me which thing to take, the responsibility is not mine. We are, at this point, not making a choice. We don't have a choice to make. We live in the information age. And if we live in the information age and want to get through the new digital era without losing our shirts in the process, it is incumbent upon each of us to take that responsibility to understand what we are being passed.
Interesting thing you said about questioning your own motives about what to choose and to believe or not to believe. We are so on the lookout for bias in one another. For, you know, what's that guy really trying to say that for? What is this person, you know, what, perhaps they've got a, they're doing this in order to do some other motive that I'm guessing at. But we never turn that mirror on ourselves. What are my biases? Why am I so willing to believe this? Why am I so skeptical of that? We do move the goalposts between different things when we do that. And we should really turn that mirror on ourselves and say, what is my bias in thinking about that? And then apply that, and then we can get something, if not objective, at least a more stable basis for what we choose to adopt into our own epistemological worldview.
Bruce, silence. I grant unto you, Bruce, the last word.
Thank you, Professor. One thing that's been mentioned a couple times in this is, been let slip, as it were, is group that some people talk about called the Illuminati. The Illuminati is, in popular culture, well, in culture anyways, one of these shadowy secret organizations we talk about, very often thought of the shadowy secret organization of all shadowy secret organizations, who a lot of people believe give off clues and symbols and various other things to sort of winkingly say to people that they exist, like they're the Riddler in Batman. Some people have claimed to be members of the Illuminati, which is itself completely, patently impossible. Because if there were such a shadowy group, obviously the first two rules would be that no one would admit they were a member of it, and that those people would not admit the existence of it. That said, I am not a member of the Illuminati, and the Illuminati does not exist. Furthermore, if such a group were to exist, they'd be the good guys. You'd want to be a member of them. Here's why. The term Illuminati comes from the Bavarian Illuminati. In the 1700s, they were a group, they were working in Bavaria, and their purpose for being was, in fact, to try to take authority from the legitimate ruler of Bavaria, that being the King of Bavaria. They were, in fact, a pro-democracy group. They met in secret because they were illegal, and they wanted to take away the authority from the king and put it in the hands of the people. The propaganda against them was pretty much that claim, which is basically true in that time and place. The reason that so much of their symbology and sayings and their beliefs show up in the early symbology of the United States is because that was the goal of the Illuminati, was the founding of a democratic nation that was not ruled by a king. They succeeded, and we got democracy as a result. So the Illuminati weren't bad guys. If they existed, they'd be a pro-democracy group. You'd want to be a member of them. That said, I'm not a member of them, and the Illuminati does not exist. That is all.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. Send us your questions. And if you like what we're doing here, support us on Patreon. Join us next time after I release my expose on Jenny McCarthyism and the House Select Committee on Idiotic Activities. I've been your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm River.
I'm Bruce.
So did you hear the moon landing was faked?
Why would they do that?
To conceal the fact they actually landed on the sun.
Steve, dispose of them. They know too much.
Security slave.